hard to tell whether an idea like that paper I sent around is something that you can actually calculate with or, you know, make some predictions. Might or might not be, you know.
But didn't he recapture Newton's law of gravitation?
Yeah, and general relativity, the Einstein equation, he gets in the end. As a straightforward relativistic generalization of Newton's law of gravity, moved through that pretty quickly. But yeah, Newton's law of gravitation, but, you know, it's all full of assumptions, too. Like, all right, he puts a sphere around it. Well, one-dimensional sphere? Well, a two-dimensional sphere in three dimensions. So what did he get? 1/r² fall off. Hello?
Online, and there's some pretty funny comments by different people. Like, I found a blog over this really big, giant check.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I
think
it was a
giant check asshole. Oh my god, he's a jerk. Holy cow. There's other websites that are like
lots of jerks on the blog of
spirit. He's a string theorist, though, and he has no,
yeah,
he doesn't like it.
Of course not.
There's a lot of different opinions, but I don't know.
Are they mostly?
I mean, the paper has no, is very, very vague. It's just like an idea, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and some ballpark estimations. It's not like a well thought out theory, and the author is pretty upfront about that.
But the polymer example has lots of atomic forces that could draw it all together into a crumpled mass.
But it's not it's the entropy that holds it together, not the...
Right. I mean, and you have to look at, like, statistical considerations to know why a rubber band shrinks when you count up.
You need a temperature, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could have... Right, so you've got these flexible bonds at each atomic juncture, right? And so it could move around one of those without any force, just constant velocity. But now if you have a gap of these things and they're bumping into one another, you've got the impact forces that actually are going to make them move. And so if you have a bunch of these polymers at some temperature, so there are collisions, they're statistically going to take some configuration where there are lots of crinkles. If you had the situation where you only have one of these molecules and there really is no preferred direction for these joints, okay, you stretch it out, there's no force. You know, if nothing bumps into it or there's no thermal agitation or quantum zero point energy. You might want to think about what that does. But if it's extended and static, it's just going to stay there. If you do have some zero point energy, so that most of these joints are they're processing around, then this thing's going to process around and, it'll curl up. But with a random angular frequency at each joint, so each joint moves with some, unless they happen to all be, nicely rational ratio multiples of one another, which, is, again, statistically unlikely. So if you give each of those joints some initial velocity, then this thing is going to, even if the initial positional configuration was straight out, it's going to, work its way into a little ball.
Aren't there van der Waals forces on?
Well, yeah, realistically, yeah, there are all kinds of forces that are that are going on.
Because the problem with the problem was set up with an initial external force.
Yeah.
And if you think about it from a cosmological standpoint, or of a more of a gravitational standpoint, there might be an initial force. Either something was exploding, or it already has angular momentum.
Yeah. You really should be careful what kind of system you set up. If you're talking about a real molecule, well, there are real forces and real temperatures, and there's actually a whole lot of stuff going on. So the fact that it takes force to pull that polymer out straight, what force is that working against? Well, the maybe there are Van der Waals forces. Van der Waals forces, like a surface tension. So there would actually be a force there that you're battling against. If you're trying to do the whole thing from like pure number, I'm not sure you actually can get a force. You certainly don't get a force until you get a distance. And if you're doing it and this is probably the way you're thinking about it. That's Sunderland, not a dumb guy. I've been around a while and thought about these things. So, figure he's probably thinking about this in a fundamental enough way that, we're pondering for a while. This is some stuff about these ideas. You think about it. See if you can make it work, or see if you can shoot holes in it. I don't know if it's right. I don't know that it's obviously wrong, but you've got to understand the point of view first, and that's going to take sort of working through some of those examples and thinking hard about whether whether you're thinking about this in a sufficiently abstract way that it makes any sense at all. So what you've done is to create a thermodynamic pair of variables. So you get TDS and TDD and extensive and intensive thermodynamic variables, right? They come in pairs. Well, what comes with a DX? An F, right? So if you can create some notion of DX by a definition of location of the particle, what is the F that is which is extrinsic and intrinsic? I forget which is which. Is it the extrinsic variables that just add like volumes? You add two volumes and now you have twice the volume. Right. So the dx is probably the extrinsic variable here, and f is the intrinsic one that arises or is the measure of the energy effect of changes in the x. Well, if you're talking about some very fundamental level where you're identifying you're developing a notion of space from positions of particles that gives you your x, that is bound to introduce some intrinsic thing to go with it. Good work.
Would it not mess with the standard model as much as other efforts to
Get
gravity in there?
Maybe that the standard model. In fact, in reading it, he's interpreting the gravitational force in some informational sense. Okay, entropy, the intrinsic variable opposed to temperature changes, has to do with counting. It's the log of the number of possible configurations of your system. if he's getting forces by creating dx, there's every reason to think he could get someone could get the unitary forces by the same kind of reasoning, having to do with degrees of freedom, right? So instead of you're defining position in some space-time, and contrary to that, you're going to get an intrinsic variable that is the gravitational force. Okay, there are more degrees of freedom. There's an FU2. And if we use that in some to create some abstract space that has more degrees of freedom than 4, then we'll get some other force that's going to be the weak interaction. And so you might be able to do the same thing with the other interaction. And create a space that has more degrees of freedom. Well, that's what a Gluon-Schick-Klein model is. Right? You take a bigger space, it's got more degrees of freedom. You compact it fine because the degrees of freedom seem to be restricted to some compact motions, but who knows if you're defining the space by the relationship of the thing. So somehow, you would want to envision, to get a standard model, you would want to envision a statistical system that has many degrees of freedom. You'd want 4 for gravity, and you'd say, or, more depending on how you want to treat it. You'd need, FU2, FU1, FU3. You've got 1 and 3 and 8 degrees of freedom there. So, you need, 14 degrees of freedom or something, depending. And then maybe you could construct a space that would contain the whole thing, and it would all be derived from some entropic consideration. I don't know. I'm making this up. might work. Give it a second reading. See if it continues to make a good sense.
Can I ask about?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Going back to a couple lectures ago,
Going back to what?
A couple lectures ago. Okay.
Yeah.
A symplectic dual. Okay.
Yeah.
You put that the coefficient matrix was like a Del or Kronecker and minus Kronecker, for example. Right. We need to find.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My question is, how do we know it's of that form exactly? How do we know? It's symplectic, of course.
Okay. Okay. So if you have closed non-degenerate two forms, let's call it capital omega. So it's closed, so the E omega is 0, and it's non-degenerate, so if you expand it in terms of some let's just take some generalized coordinates here, E, psi, A, D, psi, D, then the determinant in that sense is non-zero, so it's invertible. Then the Darboux theorem is that there exist coordinates such that let's call them chi A, such that that form is let me call it sigma AB sigma is off diagonal identity. QA and IV, so that then the omega will take the form of this is the Darboux that such coordinates exist if you have an object at this time. The d omega equals zero is an integrability condition. Right? That guarantees that you can do this globally. So, this is part of a more general study of geometry. So, if you have Riemannian geometry, and that's based on a symmetric matrix. Then you have symplectic geometry, where you base it on an anti-symmetric matrix. Two-form means it's anti-symmetric. Non-degenerate, and you can't do much with it. Well, you assume that G is non-degenerate, the metric. So it's invertible, and you can use either of these objects to start building other objects. Well, okay, so Riemann shows that if you start taking derivatives of this, you can actually build a non-trivial curvature tensor that characterizes geometric properties of the space. Darboux shows that with an anti-symmetric object of the same sort, basically, you cannot. And the proof of that is that I can always make it constant. So, and because of the integrability condition, I can do it globally. So I can find coordinates where this looks like this constant matrix everywhere, then there's no way that I'm going to build curvatures by taking derivatives of it, because all the derivatives vanish. So there are no structures like curvature that you can build from a symplectic form. So here we just get d omega zero, no generalization of curvature. Well, Darboux, in the torsion solution, where is it? Sort of halfway through that paper, effectively, I give a proof of the Darboux theorem. Within the context of the black and formal problem, I find coordinates, those x and y coordinates, are Darboux coordinates.
Seriously, you found coordinates that satisfy this for the final vector?
For which?
You actually found the chi coordinates.
Yeah. As I'm integrating the biconformal field equations in the torsion-free solution, I integrate the Weyl vector, I find, there could be this x dependencies and there could be, various stuff that would not make it of that form. And I go through a fairly careful argument there to show that actually you can choose the coordinates to make it look like this. So that's where, when I write the Weyl one form is minus YADXA, that's where that comes from. But if you look back to the, when was the paper in, at JMP, the Journal of Mathematical paper that I wrote, in there you'll see that I had written minus YA plus some alpha A of X. I had this form. And it was only when I did the torsion solution later I mean, this didn't come from a solution. This came from studying the geometry. But when I did the torsion-free solution first, I still got that form. But eventually, I was able to show that I could remove this alpha to x by careful choices of coordinates on the momentum space and by conformal transformation. You can get rid of it. You know, mechanics works like that. When you do Hamiltonian mechanics, you have a symplectic form, and you can do transformations of the coordinates to make the symplectic form simple. And those are canonical coordinates.
Your sigma matrix there with the identities on the outside pieces? We had a negative? Yeah. Okay.
Does that help?
So we wouldn't actually want to change our coordinates though in the dual, right? Symplectic dual to actually be the chi coordinates.
Yeah, you want to use those. Alright. And the sign that you're working in canonical coordinates is that this form the symplectic form takes this pure coordinate form. That means that the coefficient matrix is in the Darboux form. Well, all right, let's go back to Hamiltonian dynamics, because that's exactly what defines the canonical transformation. Right? If we have a transformation. So suppose I let QA be some function of X and T, and PA be some function of some X and T. So let Q pi be Darboux coordinate. So the symplectic form is the QA D by A. Then X T are Darboux if and only if Q pi goes to X T is a canonical transformation. So we've launched into a discussion of Hamiltonian dynamics here. Let's see what it means. Remember, first of all, what it means for a transformation to be canonical. That's one way to go at this proof, and that's immediate. A canonical transformation is one that preserves Poisson brackets. Okay, so canonical coordinates in the Hamiltonian sense are coordinates QA, pi, b, such that the Poisson brackets well, there are three sets of Poisson brackets to consider. QA with QB, Q with pi, and pi with pi. And if you consider these let's see, how do you get the first set? Remember that the Poisson bracket of any two functions is defined as the partial of f with respect to the configuration coordinate, partial g with respect to the momentum sum, minus
same thing the other way around. So once you have a set of canonical variables, okay, you take the Poisson bracket with respect to those variables. So you find one set. Well, if you look at the set itself in terms of given pi, what is this? What's the bracket of Q with Q? So you get the partial of QA with respect to QC, sum of the partial of QB with respect to pi C, minus the other way around. What is that? Okay, the QABQC
is delta AC.
The QAB pi, two and pi are independent. We're in the two n dimensional space, so that's zero. This one is zero.
Right, it's zero.
So this immediately zero. Alright, pi pi is going to be zero, and QA pi D is what? DQA D pi, DQC, that's an A there, D pi D pi C. Minus the other way around. Well, the other way around clearly is zero. So both of those are zero. But this one, both of those are Kronecker. So we end up with a Kronecker AC, a Kronecker CB gives a Kronecker AB. And that is exactly what makes a set of variables canonical. In fact, that defines the symplectic form. Right? If I let psi A be QA IB. Alright, so define one two n dimensional variable. Then the Poisson bracket of psi A with psi B. Alright, notice the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric. Right? So what am I going to get? Well, if I choose Q and pi, then I'm going to get delta AB. I get zero if I choose Q and Q, zero if I choose pi and pi, and since it's anti-symmetric, I get minus delta AB if I choose it the other way. If I choose first pi and then Q, then it's going to be this one will be the deltas instead of that one, and I get the minus sign. So, voila. That's the symplectic form. Or the inverse of the symplectic form. And, you know, once I've got that, well, I can use that to define the bracket, right? So for any two functions, I can define omega A B partial of F with respect to psi A, partial of G with respect to psi B, and this is only off diagonal with a minus sign, so I reproduce this formula. See it? So, remember, psi is either Q or pi. This is off diagonal anti-symmetric crosses. So I either get a Q pi or a pi 2 here with a relative minus sign between them. So it's exact. You guys look so sleepy today. You know, trying to get the sides to open. No, I don't. Okay, so now, what makes a transformation canonical is that it preserves the symplectic form. Another way to say it is that it preserves all Poisson brackets. Or another way to say it is that it's a transformation to new variables whose Poisson brackets satisfy this canonical form, 0, delta, 0. Any of those is a perfectly good way to define a canonical transformation. And the one that's relevant here is that, okay, so I do a transformation, it reserves the symplectic form. Well, if I write the symplectic form as a form, then what happens to it? It becomes this thing. I mean, I might get two of those. Let's put in our typical half here. Then this is going to be D, Q, A, D, I, A. Right? So if you write the symplectic form as a form in canonical variables, it'll look like this. And in a different set of canonical variables, ta-da, reserves the symplectic form, that looks the same thing. So this form is a fourth way to determine if you've got canonical variables. Let's see what happens if we actually write this out. Let's do a coordinate transformation and ask what it means to preserve the form. So if I let's suppose I define new coordinates functions of Q and pi, but some x and t. So I want to take the Poisson bracket with respect to Q and pi, but I want it to come out canonical. So right, this one is going to be d x a d q c d pi d d pi minus d x a d pi c d d d d d c. And we want this one to be Kronecker AB. If this is going to be a canonical transformation, we need this thing to give us Kronecker. And then X with X has to give us 0. And what's that? DXA, DQC, DXB, DPIC. D X A D I C D X B D U C. And we have to have B T equals 0. And if we do that, then the X and T's satisfy the canonical bracket, and that's good. Well, what is this transformation? Those things on the right are, those are, Jacobian matrices of, parts of the coordinate transformation. In fact, I can write this all at once. If I write, let's let chi A be xA dB. And we've got psi A is Q A TB. So the conditions we're asking for require chi A chi B to be what? Well, to be omega. And what that is omega dB partial of chi A with respect to psi C partial of chi B with respect to psi D. And that's the coordinate transformation under a general coordinate transformation of a tensor. Right? That's how you would transform any tensor under a coordinate transformation. And what you're saying is you want to restrict to those coordinate transformations that leave omega invariant. just like Lorentz transformations leave the Lorentz metric invariant. All right, so anything that preserves the Lorentz metric is Lorentz transformation. Well, anything that preserves the symplectic form is now a canonical transformation. And any coordinate that satisfy that can be used as your position and momentum, your configuration and momentum variables in phase space, and are equally good for describing Hamiltonian dynamics. And that's the power of Hamiltonian dynamics, that you can use these coordinates, and what you find is that you can make any classical problem trivial, in fact. Hamilton-Jacobi theory, where it is shown with a little bit of fussing with differential equations and stuff, but it is shown that any classical system satisfying Hamilton's equations, you can find such a transformation to a new set of variables in which the Hamiltonian vanishes, and therefore Hamilton's equations are trivial. The motion is basically a fixed point in phase space, and you've solved the problem. All you have to do then is transform back to the original variables, and you have the full motion of the system. It's kind of fun to work through systems like that. I think I did that in my mechanics book. If you check back to the Hamiltonian mechanics section, I think I do it for a couple of simple problems where you can actually solve the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Okay, let's see. Does that answer the question?
I guess. Okay. I just wasn't sure we could write it that way, but okay. Well, there's that line of the proof.
Okay, so let's see. Can you write it that way? Yeah, I suppose we could try and prove the Darboux theorem and actually find some coordinates to do it. So, suppose we have a closed non-degenerate two point.
Quick question.
Yeah.
For the symplectic geometries that we can't have any curvature type
yeah.
things?
Yep.
We do.
Well, we also have a metric. We have both structures.
So if you only have a symplectic geometry
yeah.
with no
yeah.
metric, okay.
Good point.
Okay.
Yeah, you like the formal space, we have both.
Let me just ask something about this this expression QA and pi B.
Yeah.
Do you get two Kronekers for the first term and
yeah.
then?
Oh yeah. This,
and then
yeah.
And then they reduce to that.
That's right.
Delta
yeah,
BC.
Yeah, you get
right?
delta
yeah.
AC, delta CB. This is down in the denominator, becomes an up, and this is down, up, is down.
Oh, why does that flip-flop like that?
Oh, well, remember that a partial derivative, right, counts as a down index. This is like, that would be a covariant vector, right? So an up index in the denominator acts as a covariant index, right, of a denominator.
Oh, I see, okay.
So here, this is a derivative with respect to something that's already covariant.
It's
covariant. From the contrary.
Okay.
Let's see. I wonder if we have any. Any clue how to go about proving the Darboux theorem from scratch? We can try it. You got all that? And are there any other questions? Man, I wish this thing had a pizza in it.
Pizza never shoots mentioned.
I know. I remember when it was left. I think I had that pizza.
I think we got lost, right? Like looking for the classroom or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What were we doing? We need the pizza. I don't know.
Feel good?
Should we send out for a pizza? I mean, you know, if someone could call, the pizza showed up, but they'd probably have to eat it. Okay, so prove the Darboux theorem. So we're given the two forms, and we know that it's closed, and we know that it's non-degenerate.
In this case, what does non-degenerate mean?
All right, so we have some coordinates. So we know that the determinant of that is non-zero. And that implies that the inverse of this exists, and we're going to define it to be something called omega AB, which is itself. So what I mean is omega AB up, omega BC is Kronecker AB. Notice that is adjacent multiplication, so I get minus that if I write BA with omega BC. So, yeah, but that's my definition of how I want to invert it, and clearly that's enough to not generate.
What, AC, delta AC?
No, B. I'm saying if I don't sum on the adjacent indices, that I pick up a minus sign. Just take the transpose here.
Right, but on the Kronecker, no. And you should be...
I should never question your question. You know, I've always done something stupid. And it just heightens it. Alright, so... let's see, we want to do a coordinate transformation. So let's change coordinates. And let's see, so what's going to happen to the components of this form? Well, all right, omega is a half, omega AB, B psi, A with B psi, B. And in any other coordinates, forms are invariant, so it will be AB. And I can write D psi as partial of psi A with respect to psi B, D psi B. And so this is going to be D psi A, D D psi A D psi B, okay? D psi B D psi B D psi B, which D psi B. And now that means that in the new system, psi C D is just this stuff. So it's just a coordinate transformation. I was just figuring out which way it went. So, okay, the first question I would ask is, can I choose this coordinate transformation to make omega tilde canonical at a point? And then we'll see if we can extend the coordinate system so it stays, you know, it's constant. So there's a chance that it will look like that everywhere, but we'll sort that out in a bit. So how do we know? This is a similarity transformation. It's you know, basically omega tilde is that's the Jacobian matrix. You know, if I put it on the other side, it's probably the transpose of the Jacobian matrix. So I've got an equation that looks like that, where I can pretty much make that matrix anything I wanted. I can make that matrix anything I want at the point. So the question is, can I turn an arbitrary anti-symmetric matrix into the Darboux form, just as one? So is there some matrix such that M transpose omega M is minus 1 and 1 at a point? Well, let's see. How would we know? We know all these terms about symmetric matrices. Now we've got an anti-symmetric one. Normal matrices are diagonal. There's the theorem. Do you know that one? Alright, so let's start with the theorem that you doubtless do remember, that a symmetric matrix can be diagonalized by an orthogonal transformation. Okay, so do you have proved that one once upon a time?
They
had some linear algebra equation to be able to prove that. Or did we just sort of believe it? But so, symmetric matrices can be diagonalized by an orthogonal transformation. Remember the proof. You want to prove it? Okay. So suppose we have a non-degenerate symmetric matrix. Well, it could be degenerate. A symmetric matrix. Solve the eigenvalue problem. Take the matrix of eigenvectors. That's the one that will diagonalize it. Right? You remember now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's. So you solve the eigenvalue problem for this metric matrix to get that. I hope this is a theorem. I'm going to try to prove it. Normal matrices are diagonal and can be diagonalized. And a normal matrix is one that commutes with its, we'll say real here, so commutes with its transpose.
I think they have real eigenvalues, right? Wait, well, anyway.
Not quite. You're thinking Hermitian.
Okay.
They have real eigenvalues.
Well, they're also normal, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. These, right, symmetric matrices are diagonal. Therefore, it better be normal. They commute with their adjoint. Well, their adjoint is their transpose, and they're equal to their transpose, and they obviously commute with themselves. So it certainly is true here. The normal matrix is let's say adjoint. If we restrict to real, then it commutes with its transpose. So suppose n dagger n equals 0. Then,
oh, right.
I think you write it as like a symmetric and an anti-symmetric bit, right? A Hermitian plus an anti-Hermitian or something like that. What is that? Let's see. I can write n as adjoint, and minus is adjoint. I think how this goes. And then this is Hermitian, because this is equal to its adjoint, and this is I times some Hermitian matrix. So we can write it as the sum of a Hermitian and an anti-Hermitian matrix. And now, let's see, what we want to do is, there exists a unitary, so the metric are, this would be Hermitian, and this would be unitary. There's no holds either way. You use the other in quantum mechanics. So there exists a unitary transformation such that UH1U inverse is diagonal. And we should call that one U1. Now, what do we want to do? I forget how the commutator comes into this. Suppose we do that transformation. So that gives us, and a coordinate system where n is a diagonal Hermitian thing, a diagonal real, right? Plus I times some H2 prime. Now, we also know that there exists U2 such that U2 H2 prime U2 inverse or dagger is some. Is also diagonal. But the trick here is, why do I need that commutator? It commutes with its adjoint.
Take E to this, like...
The two Hermitian operators commute. They're simultaneously diagonal. Right, that's what they're meaning. Now, this one's not purely Hermitian, but the I doesn't get in the way. That's the point. So how do we know that we can simultaneously diagonalize commuting matrices? Where's that term? Dig back into our quantum mechanics and try to remember when we showed that that was the case. Simultaneous eigenvectors, right? Eigenvectors. Yeah, that's the trick, right? So, since they commute, there is this a basis for each one, say, lambda 1n and lambda 2m, but these are just vectors that I'm giving this. Bracket notation? So, H1 acting on lambda 1n, lambda 2m, pulled out the lambda 1m. And H2 pulled out lambda 2. And, so simultaneous eigenvalues make up the transformation matrix built from those eigenvalues that we'll simultaneously diagonalize both of them. So, in that basis, H1 is lambda 1, 1, lambda 1, 2, lambda 1, m, and H2 is lambda 2, 1, lambda 2, n. Okay, that does. So, yeah, never mind that. Yeah, it's this that's crucial. So, yeah, this, we don't need that. Seems like there might be another way to say that does that, but so any matrix that commutes with its adjoint can be diagonal. Okay, and let's see the well, we don't need to prove everything. We'll be back doing so. So let's not push that one further, but. Okay, so normal matrices are diagonable, and so over here, omega dagger equals omega transpose equals minus omega implies omega commutes with its adjoint. And that means it's diagonal. Choose those matrices at least at a point to diagonalize it.
You mean this twice? Omega equals omega transpose, right? Right, no. You have omega.
Omega
transpose.
Dagger.
Oh.
That's a dagger.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm just using the theorem the way we stated it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we've got to read the theorem with that. But anyway, the transpose is minus omega.
Okay.
That, okay. And therefore, by this proof, it can be diagonalized, and therefore, since an arbitrary coordinate transformation at some fixed point can be made arbitrary, we just choose these matrices to be the ones that diagonalize it. They exist, and we have free choices of coordinate transformation, so we can do that. The question is the interoperability condition. Can we actually make that coordinate choice global? So can we extend that choice at a point to something that actually does this at every point? And why not?
But these aren't diagonal, are they? I mean, let's see. Like,
which,
in the with the 1-1? Or do you have to rotate them somehow?
Okay. In that basis, since it's anti-symmetric, it's pure imaginary. All right, so yeah, you're right. We're not done yet. That's not starting to form yet. So we can make it diagonal. The diagonal elements, e.g., proof left to reader, proof that the eigenvalues of an anti-Hermitian matrix are pure imaginary. Right. That's an easy one. Then, get over here. So now we want to turn that into canonical form. Well, I'm betting it's some sort of a 45-degree rotation. Let's see what does it. Can't be too bad. All right, we want to take I lambda 1, I lambda n. And let's do another unitary transformation that makes it Darboux form. So let's see. What we want to get here is the identity and minus the identity, something like that. So what's going to have to be the case? These guys. Probably, let's see, if they're blocked off diagonal that way, I'm going to get 0 something and something 0. But then, there's something, no, that's going to come back.
Yeah. Let's do a trivial example and see what it ought to look like. So if I have sigma z, how do I rotate that 90 degrees? Into, I know that I can rotate that into what? That's I minus y. Okay, just I times y. Right, just I times sigma z. Okay, so then 90 degree rotation is going to take sigma z into sigma y. So I sigma z is going to go to I sigma y is equal to 1 minus 1. So it is a 90 degree rotation. From subspace. So what is the 90 degree rotation? We want to rotate around the x axis by 90 degrees. The unitary transformation that does that, I over 2 m dot sigma, so we need a sigma x here, and we need an angle of pi over 2. Right? So e to the I pi over 4 sigma x is going to do it. And what is that? That's going to be cosine pi over 4 plus, let's see, I sigma x sine pi over 4, which is cosine pi over 4 times pi over 4 is 1 over root 2. So then we have 1 sigma x, we're going to have I's here and 1 here, so something like this. So let's try identity, I times the identity, I times the identity, and identity. The dagger is going to make those minus. And then here we have 1, 1, I, 1, I, 1. Does it do it?
The minus, I think.
What's that?
Other minus.
So. 1, I, 1, then, okay, this product, we're going to get, right up here, we're going to have, let's see, I lambda 1 through, let's call it 2n down here, I lambda n, and nothing there. Then down below we're going to get lambda 1 through lambda n. And then this one we're going to get lambda, or, sorry, this is lambda n plus 1 through lambda 2n. Then we're going to get lambda 1 through lambda n here. And then finally, I lambda n plus 1 through I lambda 2n down there. Now we multiply again. We do have to normalize all these eigenvalues, right? So this is going to be 1 plus I times. I lost some. Did I lose my sense? No. My eyes are coming out backwards here. Why? I need some minus sign. That's fine factor. What effect does this play? What would that change? This would be the same. That would be minus. This would be minus, and that would be the same. Then if I do this, I have I, yeah, minus I, zero, good. Okay, here I get a minus 2 times lambda n plus 1 through lambda 2n. Up here, I get minus that pi squared times, oh, wait a minute. It's the sum. I get minus 2, or no, just minus, then I'm going to have lambda 1 through lambda n, and lambda n plus 1 through lambda 2n. Then up here I get the same thing with the opposite sign. I'm going to have, is it the opposite sign? Minus.
Why is this coming out?
It should come out of Andy's metric. I. Minus.
Why is this zero?
Yeah, it's not quite zero. Yeah, it's, you know, the plus. Okay, all right. So, the eigenvalues of an antisymmetric matrix what's it going to be? Are half of them going to be complex conjugates of the other? You know, once we have a diagonal matrix, we can choose the coordinate transformations that's just a scaling. We can make them all one. Right? We don't usually do that because we're interested in the eigenvalues, but we could choose a scaling to make it all unit norms eigenvalues. The thing is, half of them have to be plus 1 and half have to be minus 1 because the trace of an Andrew-metric matrix is 0, so the trace has to stay 0. So half of these are going to be I and half are going to be minus I. So let's
I would try it.
Put N1s and N minus or n i's and n minus i's. So I claim we can get it into that form. Right, that's getting closer. In fact, that's sigma z, right? I sigma z. So it really got to work. So let's see. Did I do something funny with the?
So we can call it I times identity and minus I times identity, right?
Yeah. Right. And then it's just the same problem we did here.
Oh.
So, we're done. Right, yeah. So, let me just write that out so the board doesn't look silly. So, you know, this is 1 minus I, 1. Let's see. Do you know which signs this works on? Here we have I, I get the, and we have 1, and we have minus 1, and we have minus I identity. And then we get I1 minus I1 is 0. Then we get 1 plus 1 is 2 times the identity. And then here, minus 1, minus 1 is minus 2 times the identity. And finally, we have I1 minus I1 is 0. And we forgot the factors of 1 over root 2. And we've got our root form. There. At a point. Now we need the integrability condition to show that we can do that everywhere. Let's see. We're probably not going to have enough time left today to do electron-electron scattering. All right. let's think about the other half of the problem a minute anyway. See what has to happen. We want to choose these derivatives to do that at every point. Now, what prevents our doing that in the Riemannian geometry case? All right, so I can do the same thing in a Riemannian geometry. I can find a coordinate transformation that makes the metric into Minkowski at a point. So what if I try to extend that coordinate system further? Well, first off, the way I do it is I choose a geodesic coordinate system, a Gaussian normal coordinates is what it's called. And in Gaussian normal coordinates, what I've done is to choose the connection, gamma, the Christoffel connection to be 0 at the same point. And I can do that. There's a lot of freedom here. I can choose both of those to be 0. And what happens then is I can expand the coordinate system in this Gaussian normal frame out to second order in the coordinate displacement before now I pick up derivatives of the Christoffel symbols, that second derivative of the metric. And what you show is that thing is a tensor called the curvature tensor, and you cannot make that 0 at a point because the curvature is a tensor. If it's not 0 to start with, you're toast. So you can choose a Gaussian normal coordinate system which in an epsilon size neighborhood is Minkowski up to second order in the coordinate differences from a point. The integrability condition required for being able to choose the Christoffel symbol of 0 at a point is its symmetry. The fact that it's symmetric, I think, is what guarantees that you can make it 0 at a point. Okay, now we want to do the same kind of thing. We want to extend our coordinate system the thing is, if we have coordinates, so we're given some coordinates. If we expand omega AB in those coordinates in the Taylor series around some point, right, at the initial point, we've shown that we can make it Darboux. Okay, now we want to choose coordinates in that neighborhood so that perhaps the first derivatives vanish. Well, in fact, the thing is closed, so the first derivatives are going to vanish. Well, not quite. This is the integrability condition that guarantees that we can choose coordinates where that those first derivatives vanish. let's see how that plays out. Push that erase down there. All the erasers are down here. Coordinate transformation. This may not be quite the right way to go. Let's take this expansion and write it as a differential form. So we've got omega 0 AB. Then omega 0, just that form. So AB, comma C, D, psi A, D, psi B. And then if I choose this to be the origin, then I've just got a psi D on here. And what I want is that just makes a tree form on it. So I just get D psi C here, and that's the usual condition. Trying to remember how this Gaussian normal coordinates thing works. It seems like the thing to do is to take a derivative of this equation that we'd like to solve. What's the first derivative there? Omega prime. If you take another derivative of that, you get some second derivatives of psi with the coordinate transformation. Let's see, we've chosen the initial conditions, right? So the derivatives psi c comma a, we've chosen those at the origin to be a certain matrix, but we haven't chosen those second derivatives. So the thing that we want to do is regard that equation as, take the derivative of that equation and regard that as a differential equation for those second derivatives. We want to determine the second derivative to be what it takes to make that equation whole.
So the second equation?
Yeah, so okay. 0 equals omega prime sub AB comma C, that one. Take a derivative of that, it's going to be a symmetric thing. You'll get three terms, each with a second derivative, one each having a second derivative.
Are these Xi's coordinate transformations?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The derivative is the Jacobian matrix.
Okay.
Right. So we've specified the Jacobian matrix at psi equals 0, but now we're saying how to expand it away from that point.
So we have a Jacobian matrix on a derivative, is that what we're doing over here? Because there's three Xi's, Xi's, or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're trying to transform the coefficient in the Taylor series. So we want to pick coordinates where those are 0. And the thing is, you're going to get an integrability condition. Let me try it. See if that works. So we're going to have 0 is omega 0 DEF. And then, you know, we'll get various things here. Psi D A G Psi E D. But these are just Jacobian matrices, so that's, let me call that J E D. The J F F D. And then there's a J D A Psi E D G J F T, and there's a J D A J D Psi F D G, something like that. And let's see, these first two, this one and that one, are equivalent, because if I interchange DE, let's see, what happens? Do they
get zero or two?
one or the other, right? So I could rename this term omega E D comma F. Here, just renaming, then I have a J E A Psi D D G. And then I can put those indices, so I get a minus D E F J E A Psi D D G. And yeah, the only thing then that's different is the AB. So I could make a two form of this. I could put a D psi A, D psi B on this whole thing. It's got the antisymmetric on AB because they're contracted on this thing. I could have put those in up here. And let's see. Yeah, maybe I can do that right away up here. So if I think of this thing up here as a form, but I'm taking a partial f of it, and then we transform just that extra index, leaving this part coordinate invariant, that just changes the basis. Then, dg of that thing. Then I have omega 2 form. Plus the derivative, hit these coefficients. Yeah, so I get something like this. And what I would like to do, I want that whole thing to be zero. If I make a differential form of this thing, so you know, I want to think of this as an equation for that psi. I'm essentially looking at something where this second derivative. And what is it? Is the first derivative is a Jacobian. Let me think of it as D of the Jacobian needs to be something like minus omega zero inverse D omega zero. Looks like the gauge condition. Right? We've seen that enough in Riemannian geometry. Alright, so the irreducibility condition for this, suppose we can actually get it precisely into this form. the integrability for this condition for J is D squared equals zero, but D of this is proportional to D omega, which is zero to this flow. So this looks like we might be able to get to an end. I mean, this is all very crude sketch of something that might work. But if we can cast the problem of zeroing this out as a differential equation for the Jacobian, right, the derivatives of the Jacobian have to be something, then I'm fairly sure that the integrability condition for that is going to be satisfied by the closed condition. And if that's the case, then we've extended the coordinates of the now.
It's interesting. Yeah, this might be fun to look at in a little more detail. The thing that we're trying to build objects in a symplectic geometry, what happens if you go through the same things that Riemann did with the metric and try to build, what happens? You build a connection out of the symplectic form instead of building it out of the metric. You demand metric compatibility, well, demand connection compatibility. And what happens? The antisymmetry is going to do it in. That's what's going to happen. Maybe that's a whole other approach we could take to this problem. We could suppose that we build a covariant derivative, covariant with respect to transformations that preserve the symplectic structure rather than transformations that preserve the metric structure. So, total analogy. So then we build a connection. Well, if we have metric compatibility, we have some derivative that gives us zero on this form, and this has got some sort of a connection on here. So this is partial A omega D V, and seems to me the same thing that we do for the metric is going to hold. We're going to have omega AB comma C plus omega AC comma B minus omega DC comma A. We have to check that. We have to do that some difference trick, right? Right, so the thing that lets us solve this equation for the connection, right, is we write this out in terms of the partials of the metric plus two connection terms, and then we cycle the indices and we take the sum of two and the difference of the third. And that lets us isolate the connection in terms of derivatives of omega. So presumably there is some way to solve that for omega 2, but we have to check whether or not that some difference trick works, or whether we needed something else. So then we should check and see what that thing works. Look at that kind of construction. Maybe that kind of construction would do it. So there are two possible routes, anyway. Look at the explicit coordinate transformation. If you'd like a reference on that sort of approach, Weinberg discusses these Gaussian normal coordinates and the conditions you need on the coordinate transformations in terms of initial conditions for your choice of Jacobian. He has a nice discussion on that in general relativity that shows that you can choose this Gaussian normal neighborhood. It might be... I think he shows that you can choose coordinates to diagonalize the metric at a point, and make the connection vanish at a point, so you get this neighborhood. I think he has that proof.
you know, for this, just try it. You know the technique, so you know, see if you can see what happens if you try to do this.
Like you said, Christoph's connection for
So what are we looking for? We're looking for a symplectic form compatible connection.
Okay.
So that we can take derivatives while preserving the symplectic structure. You know, whatever. Yeah, if there is such a thing. The anti-symmetry at some point, you know, one approach or the other is going to be key in showing nothing interesting. There's no way to build anything that's interesting. You know, if we could construct such a covariant derivative, then we could make tensors by commuting them, right? So if we can get a connection this way, then by taking the commutator of the covariant derivative with itself, acting on some vector or something, the usual trick should lead to some curvature tensor built out in the symplectic form, but there is nothing.
Oh, yeah.
So this route ought to break down at some point, and that might give us an insight. So, one more for Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Give it a try. See what happens. Nathan's excused. He's got a proposal tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're on for 2 o'clock.
Yeah, we are.
Great, cool. I forgot to set my alarm. I got to set my alarm. I need to set an alarm on my computer.
Oh, okay.
Don't worry, mind.
Well, the project was good. I'm not worried about it. The project was good. I had been planning on electron scattering today. Do you guys want to see another field theory thing, or should we just do research for the rest of the term? What will keep you awake, Beth? I've got to show Joe scattering. So I've posted the one. I'll work out. I want to do, you know, electron scattering off of, you know, maybe a proton or a positron. You know, the positron's just a special case where the masses are equal. The answer in that case is messier than electron-electron scattering. Electrons and positrons scatter differently than electrons and electrons, which is not something that you get from Rutherford. Right? Maxwell and Rutherford say, no, they scatter the same way. You know, it doesn't matter if they're attractive or repulsive, it's a Coulomb thing, you get the same differential cross-section. But in QED with spinners, they're very different. Then, you know, you can find measurements of these sorts of things. It's really cool. I would contemplate doing the photon-photon scattering, except that Isikson and Zuber work out everything. Say it's a really tedious calculation. So I don't think we should take that one on unless we're planning on spending the rest of the term sorting out the science. there are lots of things. These were all worked out amazingly early. Electron-electron scattering was done in 1930 by Mott and Moeller. BABA, B-H-A-B-B-A, did electron-positron scattering, I think the year that Dirac predicted the positron, 1936, anyway. I'm not sure which year Dirac came up with the Dirac equation and the positron, but it was like no time at all before BABA went out and calculated the BABA cross-section for electron-positron scattering. And they dealt with, you know, looked for it immediately. Mott scattering is the generalization of the Coulomb, I think. You know, there are all these names that, you know, people who, you know, almost a century ago now, worked out the field theory answers to the classical 19th century cross section found, you know, but you remember the one, you'll look at it online, but the last one we did, but oh, what did we did? It was a muon production, so photo production of muons. from an electron annihilation with a positron. And, you know, it's got, like, all these mass ratios and stuff coming in. And you have, angular dependencies. You can have all kinds of stuff happening that's very different, and different for spinners and scalars. So we'll talk about that. We should just get that. Try and construct the curvature of my big form. Something will go wrong. Okay. I'll try to get the pictures up. Didn't get good this week. All day yesterday working out. Baba stuttering.
Oh.
Did it wrong. That's the wrong particle coming in. Just a fine cleaning out to get it right.
Bit in Spanish, actually.
What, Mama?
Yeah.